We never crossed paths with him or his crew. After a while, I remembered some dude screaming, "Thug Life!" as we left a juvenile hell in-store appearance. That must have been what Pac was talking about. Some meaningless bullshit. Tupac was just furious, because we was going at him and Snoop without a care. Mobb Deep held it down for New York when nobody else would, because they were scared of them Death Row boys. Less than a month later, in September 1996, Tupac was murdered in Las Vegas after a Mike Tyson fight. He and Suge Knight got into an altercation and jumped a member of the Crips gang inside the MGM casino. Didn't these fools know that casinos have cameras covering every angle of the joint? Right after they jumped the guy, Pac was shot 4 times while leaving in Suge's BMW. He died 6 days later. When we found out what happened to Tupac, we immediately pulled our song Drop a Gem off of the radio out of respect for his family. To tell you the truth, we felt sad that he was killed, but relieved at the same time. It would have seriously been a problem if we ever clashed with homie. We were glad it never got to that point. Years later, I found out that my people's E-Money bags and Majesty and Stretch were real tight with Tupac. One of the members of Tupac's group, the Outlaws, Young Noble, is Majesty's blood cousin. So, though we didn't know it back then, we were all on the same team anyway. Back in Queensbridge, Tragedy's man Noriega, aka Nori, started hanging out on 12th Street. He told me he was from Left Rack, but I ain't never seen him when I was living out there. Nori had just came home from jail where he had met Capone after Capone had gotten locked up for supposedly shooting a cop in the neck right in front of Havoc's building. He only did a few years for that case and somehow came home early. One night that winter, Havoc and I were on the block with Karate Joe, Gotti, Nitty, Trip, this kid we called Bill Cosby, and this other kid, Johnny. Havoc started flipping out, saying he heard Tragedy was fucking his lady Shauna on the low, and he wanted to step to Tragedy about it. We all walked over to Capone's building next door, where Tragedy, Capone, and Nori hung out. Hav knocked on Capone's door and asked him to tell Tragedy to come outside. Tragedy came out with Nori and Capone. "What's up, man? You fucking with Shauna?" Hav asked. Tragedy said it wasn't true, but Hav wasn't trying to hear it. "I know you fucking with Shauna. Stop fucking lying." Hav punched Tragedy in the face and knocked him to the ground. While he was getting back up, Karate Joe warned Tragedy, "You better not hit him back." Hav punched Tragedy again and knocked him down again, while we surrounded them, watching. Nori was getting nervous, seeing the nigga who he thought had strength in QB getting his ass beat. He was worried he was going to be next, so he reached for his gun, pulled it out, and shot one bullet at the ground between all of us. The bullet bounced off the cement and hit my man Johnny in the shin bone. Nori ran for his life out the projects. Tragedy and Capone ran into the building, and someone drove Johnny to the hospital right away. The next day, Johnny came through the block on crutches with a cast on his leg. Nori could never show his face in Queensbridge again. About a month passed, and some unknowing fool set up a show for Mobb Deep and Capone and Noriega at a little club called Crystals on Merrick Boulevard in Jamaica, Queens, across the street from the bus terminal and up the block from my grandmother's dance school. The only reason we went was so we could catch Nori and torture him for what he did to Johnny. The whole crew pulled up and parked our trucks in the bus terminal facing the club to get a good look at everybody out front. Tragedy and Capone were standing at the front door facing us. Nitty spotted Nori walking over to them. "Anyone got a razor?" Nitty asked Twin and me, but we didn't. Nitty, Twin, and Money No approached Nori. "Come over here so we can talk," Nitty told him. putting his arm around Nori's neck and walking him into the street. After a few steps, Nitty started punching Nori in the face while he had him in the headlock. Nori dropped to the ground and the crew jumped him. Gotti, Havoc, and I stood by the trucks and watched them beat the clothes off of that boy. Man, I never saw somebody get jumped so bad. They were like dogs fighting over a piece of meat. Karate Joe grabbed Nori by what was left of his shirt and dragged him into the corner so he could have him all to himself. He focused strictly on his rib cage, destroying Nori's ribs with punch after punch. Nitty snatched Nori's Jesus piece off the ground and we hopped back in our trucks. While Nori was getting jumped, his boys, Tragedy and Capone, didn't move. They just stood in front of the club watching the whole thing. Some of Nori's peoples carried him to the parking lot around the corner. I already knew what was going to happen next. You know they about to come from that parking lot with guns, I told Twin Gambino. We sat and waited. I popped the hood and told Twin Gambino to get my gun out. I just bought an automatic 2.2 with a 12-shot clip, but like an asshole, I never tested it out. After a few minutes, just as I predicted, a few of Nori's people came dragging him from the parking lot with a Tech 9. I was sitting in the driver's seat. Gambino was outside, standing at my door. We had to drop on them, meaning we could move on them before they saw it coming. Start shooting, I told Twin calmly, but the gun didn't fire. The piece of shit was broken. Nori's people started unloading their gun on us. As their bullets started to explode, Gambino got frustrated with my broken gun and threw it at them. Shoot him! Nori pointed at Nitty, who was in between my truck and Havoc's truck. Right there! Whoever had the gun shot Nitty in his back as he was trying to jump into my back seat. Plus, the shooter dumped the entire 42-shot clip at us, and not one of the shots hit the two trucks. I was shocked. The only target they hit was the person they was after. Luckily, Mary Immaculate Hospital was right around the block from Crystal's. Nitty was screaming and bleeding like a pig in my back seat as I sped to the hospital in less than 5 minutes. When we got to the emergency entrance, Money No, Twin, Karate Joe, and I dragged Nitty inside. The D's showed up a few minutes later to question everybody. Two detectives came over and questioned me while I was smoking a cigarette outside the emergency room door. I told them we were about to do a show, and somebody started shooting at us for no reason. We don't know who it was, I said. They asked me over and over to see if I was lying, but I kept saying the same thing. Eventually, they got tired and left. Havoc thought he found out who was snitching on his brother killer. At the trial, at Queens Criminal Court, the whole crew sat in the middle of the courtroom, waiting to see who the DA's star witness was going to be. We couldn't believe it when he came walking up to the stand. It was Capone. Was Capone the fucking snitch? Capone got up there and said he saw Killer pull a trigger and shoot the man in the back of the head. He pointed at Killer. I saw him do it, he said. He shot the man. He was on a stand, snitching like it was cool. Later, I heard he was trying to lower a sentence for a case he had caught for a direct sale to an undercover. Wow. The false testimony Capone gave wound up backfiring. The autopsy report said that the man was shot in the front of the head, not the back. Killer beat the case. After that, Capone tried telling everybody that he did it on purpose to help Killer beat the case. What? I don't know for sure. Maybe he did know what he was doing. Maybe his testimony did help. But from then on, instead of Capone and Noriega, the whole hood called them Canary and Nori Faker. While Killer was locked up, he became a full-fledged Muslim. When he came home, it took a while to get used to. This wild-ass nigga is a peace-loving Muslim now? I like the new killer, though. We'd have deep conversations about life. I started reading books by Dr. York, a spiritual leader from Bushwick, Brooklyn, who taught about the origin of all races and religions. If you listen to the Hell on Earth album, you could hear how my rhymes started changing at that time. I started rapping about the Illuminati, secret societies, the corrupt government, and becoming more conscious of my surroundings, going through a mental and spiritual change, just like Killer. That seed that my mom's planted in my head with Malcolm X's autobiography was starting to grow. My lady Kiki and I had to move, because she wasn't getting along with her mom's. After a while, her mom's busted me sleeping in her closet, so I stayed over a lot now that her mom's knew. My cousin Stobo and his baby mother just had gotten a two-bedroom apartment underneath the train tracks in East New York, Brooklyn, and offered us an extra room. Kiki was 4 months pregnant, and we found out we were having a boy. I was happy. Yeah, I'm ready to have a son. I didn't even know what being ready to have a kid meant. I was just ready. We were really in love. I had been all over the world and realized that Kiki wasn't one of those money-hungry hoes. She was a special girl. Kiki was 8.5 months pregnant when my man from Art and Design, Illa G, came back to New York from Virginia. Remember that kid with the Scorpio ring who was scheming on me in the school bathroom? Yeah, he ended up being one of my closest homeboys, the rapper Illa G from Some of the Projects, Brooklyn. G had taken over his cousin's dope neighborhood down south in Richmond, Virginia, while his cousin was serving 7 years. His cousin called G like, "Yo, take over my neighborhood for me." G approached me and not giving him some startup money before he went back. "Pete, put a little bit of money up and I can get you a whole lot," he promised. And he'd been down there getting mad money. He was shining with a huge Mary Mother of God piece hanging from a big gold link, similar to the one I bought Havoc back in the day, but without the ruby in the middle. G told me he had to hook up with some guns in Virginia for dirt cheap. I was in need of new toys, so I decided to drive down on a Friday, get the hardware, and head back to New York by no later than Monday. G and I slept at these two girls' crib on a block full of dope addicts called Church Hill, the same place where G had been staying while he was out there getting money. Saturday morning, G got in contact with the Connect and told him what we wanted. 2 9mm Rugers. And that same afternoon, the Connect came back with the hammers and we gave him the bread. Things were going even faster than I planned. I should have left as soon as I got what I came for, but instead, I decided to hang out at some club that night. Stupid move. On the way back from the club to the girl's house, we ran into a roadblock. G was driving my black Tahoe. He didn't have a license, and the two girls were in the back seat. There were at least 7 cars ahead of us before it was our turn to show paperwork. So G and I climbed over each other and switched seats. The hammers were in the engine, but I kept the clips in the car because the temperature was so hot, I didn't want the bullets to explode in the engine. When we got to the roadblock, the cop asked for my paperwork. "I saw you guys switch seats," he said. "Step out the truck." The officer searched the truck, found the clips, and asked where the guns were. "There aren't any guns," I told him. While he was searching my truck, he saw the blood stains on the floor and the seat belts in the back right side passenger door from when Nitty had gotten shot. "What's this?" he asked. "Blood?" I told him the truth. "Yeah, my friend got shot. I had to take him to the hospital." "Oh yeah? When did this happen?" He was acting like we had just committed a murder, and he was going to get promoted to captain for busting us. He read me my rights, impounded my truck, and sent me to the Richmond City Jail for the clips. They didn't have anything on G and the girls, because I took the blame for the clips, so they caught a cab home. When I was finally allowed to use the phone a couple of hours later, I called home and told Kiki to call my Uncle Lenny so he can contact his sister Connie in Richmond to get me a lawyer.
I told you not to go down there. I told you so,
she said.
Now I'm going to have this baby while you're in jail. I told you so.
After 2 days on the Richmond County tier, Illa G and the two girls came to visit. We laughed about what had happened and laughed some more. G is a funny nigga. He always cracked me up. I was locked up for 2 weeks before I saw the judge. Aunt Connie had a government job and had me transferred to the county medical ward so they wouldn't send me to the penitentiary while I was waiting to see the judge. After 2 more days, they moved me to the medical ward and gave me shots of Demerol every 5 hours for sickle cell pain that I wasn't even having. Shit, I'd rather be chained to a hospital bed getting high on Demerol around the clock than sitting in a jailhouse with a bunch of dirty South criminals talking about, "Hey, y'all, Mob Deep, can I rap for you? I know your cousin's out here. Just ask them." 3 days later, I went to court. Aunt Connie had got me one of the best lawyers in the state of Virginia. I got out the same day on $1,000 bail. Aunt Connie was waiting for me outside. Aunt Connie's a tough lady, smoked a lot of cigarettes, and drank a lot of Jack Daniels. "Come on, I'm taking you to see your cousins," she said. "You know you owe me big time now." She took me back to her crib to visit my cousins Manu and Diallo. I hadn't seen them since I got my first tattoo. As a kid, I was scared of them, because they used to always fight and fuck each other up. I figured if they did that to each other, then they might do the same to me. My cousins were way more calm and cool now. Manu, the older, bigger brother, had been shot in the face a few times with a Uzi submachine gun a year before. He was heavy into the streets in Richmond. I heard about the shooting from Uncle Lenny, but Manu's face didn't look as bad as I had imagined. He had 2 bullet hole scars next to his right eye that looked like little bubbles. I figured an Uzi would Swiss cheese his whole face. Manu and Diallo were happy to see me, because now they had a famous rapper in the family. It was a big thing for them. They showed me off to all their friends and took me around the neighborhood. It was filled with heroin addicts. Young kids out there thought it was cool to smoke weed and sniff heroin. They called it diesel. I wanted to check out the mall across from their house, but my cousins were banned for starting too many fights. I was just as happy to hang out with them. It was a coincidence that my cousin's friends were hustling with my man Illa G from New York. They told me that he was doing his thing in the streets. Richmond was a small community, and anybody who's somebody knows each other. I had to stay until my court case was over. The lawyer promised he would make it as quick as possible. They also kept my truck impounded until the case ended. I called home every day because Kiki was about to give birth. Plus, she was planning a baby shower in Brooklyn and wanted me to get DJ Clue to do the music. She was mad at me because I got locked up and couldn't be there with her. A whole bunch of "I told you so's." I felt bad. But she was going to be all right. I had to make sure my freedom was going to be all right. I contacted Clue, and he said he would do it. DJ Clue made a big name for himself by using a lot of Mobb Deep songs on his mixtapes before the songs were even supposed to be out. We found out later that he was getting his songs from an engineer we used to work with named Duro. Little did we know, Duro was Clue's partner while he was our studio engineer. Clue owed us a lot of favors. After a couple of weeks of hanging out at local clubs and in the Richmond hoods with my cousins and Illa G, I finally got my case thrown out. At my last court date, my lawyer was like, "Look, you don't have a gun, so you don't have a case." To top it off, my lawyer was so good that he made the DA give me back my clips right in the courtroom, fully loaded with black talons. Holy shit, I never saw or heard nothing like that in my life. Illa got me a ride to the pound to pick up my truck. Man, this is feeling like deja vu. I thought that as soon as I told him my name and that I was here to pick up my black Tahoe, they were going to lock me up again for the guns in the engine. Two guys behind the desk were giving me dirty looks and told me that I had to wait while they processed my information. 20 minutes later, a black detective car pulled up and two D's walked inside the pound lot and started searching my Tahoe all over again, taking their time. For sure, they're going to pop the hood and find them. But they didn't. They gave me my ride back and I was out. Back in my cousin's crib, Illa, Mano, and Diallo helped me wash the remaining blood out the carpet before I drove back to New York. When Nitty got shot, I had washed the blood off the seats and the door, but never got around to the carpet. It still wasn't all the way out, but it was the best we can do. I thanked my cousins and Aunt Connie and got the fuck out of Dodge. Even though I had a minor setback and paid an extra $2,500 for the lawyer's fees, it was a mission accomplished. I had two new guns with full clips, all together inside the engine this time, and I was on my way home. When I got back, I wanted to kiss the dirty New York streets. I was so happy. I went straight to Kiki's crib, and we packed our stuff and moved in with Stobo and his baby moms in East New York. It was a small railroad apartment, but we had our own space, and we weren't going back and forth between Kiki's moms and grandmoms anymore. 1996 was a year of tremendous joy and pain. A few weeks later, Illa G's brother Tim called me and told me G got locked up in Virginia. "He was in somebody's crib and got raided by the task force," he said. "They found weapons, drugs, boxes of money, bulletproof vests, and charged G with kingpin charges. They sentenced Illa to 5 years in the Virginia penitentiary." Crazy. I was just with this nigga. Killer Black started busting his gun again. He had a smart mouth and got into an argument on a hill in Queensbridge with this drug dealer named Dope, who was clashing with Little Lord. Dope pulled out a .22 revolver. Killer tried to grab the gun, but Dope squeezed the trigger. A bullet went through Killer's hand. He let go and started running. Another bullet hit his arm. Then another hit the back of his head. Killer dropped to the ground. When he realized he wasn't dead, he got up and kept running home. Later that night, Killer called and I went to his crib to see him. He was wrapped in bandages, and you could actually see the bullet sticking halfway out the back of his head. One of his boys found pain medicine from some girl, but he needed me to take him to the hospital in Long Island to treat his wounds. He couldn't go to a hospital in Queens, or the D's might come for questioning and lock him up. So I took Killer to Mercy Hospital around the block from my crib in Hempstead. The bullet in Killer's hand had gone in and out. The other bullet broke his arm. He didn't even tell him about the headshot. The bullet was just stuck in his skull. After they put a cast on his arm, he lay low at my grandmother's crib for a week before going back to QB. All that Muslim stuff was out the window, and Killer went right back to business. That bullet to the head had him acting strange. He wasn't that quiet, no-nonsense Killer Black we all knew. Late one night, I pulled up on the hill at 2 a.m., and like 20 dudes were up there hustling, drinking, and doing the regular. A bunch of them called me over, asking me to take Killer home because they couldn't control him. "You need to take care of your homie, he bugging," they said, scared he might do something to one of them. Killer leaned against the wall with a look in his eyes like he was about to snap at any minute. I put him in the car, drove to his block, and we walked up to the crib. On the way, he was slurring his words, and I realized that he was just drunk and needed sleep. The next morning, he called early, asking to borrow some money. So I left my bed in Brooklyn and went to Hav's crib to give Killer some dough. Since coming back from North Carolina, Havoc had moved out his mom's crib and was living in the Best Western City View Hotel in Long Island City, Queens, bringing girls by and living the life. When I got to his crib in Queensbridge, Killer showed me how he had been picking at the bullet in his head, which finally came out after a few weeks. "I've been seeing things in my room at night," he said. "I've been having conversations with the Egyptian King Tut. I know it sounds crazy, but I'm really seeing and talking to King Tut." I listened real close, because even though Killer did some wild shit, Killer wasn't crazy at all. He was very intelligent. The only time he ever shot somebody for no reason was when he killed that guy for the Walkman speakers, and he was extra drunk that night. Any other time he fired his gun, it was because somebody was trying to mess with him or mess with us. We spoke for a few hours. I gave him the money and left. Killer walked me down to the door, and we had a few last words. While we were talking in front of the building, this little dude named Worm rode past on a pedal bike and shouted out,
"Oh, shit! Yo, Prodigy, what up, kid?"
Killer and I were ending a deep conversation, so I didn't pay the kid much mind. "What up?" I said. He stopped his bike, but I just figured he was mumbling, excited to see me. Killer and I gave each other a pound when the little dude rode off shouting,
"A word, it's like that, all right."
The fuck was that about? I wondered, brushing it off. Twin Gambino and Money Know were waiting for me in the Tahoe. We drove to the corner store to buy a White Owl blunt. Money Know hopped out to get it. And while he was in the store, I saw my man Bumpy riding a pedal bike across the street from 40th Avenue with the little dude Worm on the back, standing on the pegs. "Yo, that little motherfucker over there got a gun out," Money Know said when he got in the truck. I turned and saw Worm swinging a chrome .45 caliber in his hand, shouting something. "So what?" I said, grabbing the White Owl for Money No, opening it to roll up the weed. Gambino was staring at Worm. "Pull off, P. This nigga bugging," he said. "I'm not pulling off because he's got a gun," I said. "Fuck he gonna do, shoot us?" "Yo, P, pull off," Gambino said again. "Son, I'm not pulling off of this little clown. When I'm supposed to be scared because he got a gun? If we pulled off, he might think we were scared of him. If somebody's waving a shiny chrome gun around, then that person's obviously trying to scare somebody. If he was going to use the gun, why would he wave it around for 5 minutes first?" Gambino demanded that I pull off. And as soon as I bent the corner on the 21st Street, this little chump shot the gun in the air just like I thought. I'll deal with him when I'm back on his side. I dropped Money No and Twin off and bounced to see my baby Kiki. That night, I took Kiki out to eat at a diner on Jackson Boulevard down the block from Queensbridge. She ordered her favorite dish, shrimp scampi, and I ordered my usual, the broiled filet of sole. 10 minutes into our meal, Kiki's water broke. She'd been having some contractions all day, and we later found out that seafood induces labor. We rushed to St. John's Hospital on Queens Boulevard, and they pushed her in a wheelchair straight to the delivery room. "The baby's coming," the doctor said. "It might take some time." Man, I was happy, nervous, anxious, shook, and a whole bunch of other emotions all at the same time. I held Kiki's hand She was crushing mine while she breathed.